This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm James Carlton. Welcome to God Forbid this week. Over the next 40 years, more than 6 million Australians will have some form of dementia, most likely Alzheimer's disease. 6 million Australians over 40 years. Once you reach the age of 85, there's a 50-50 chance it'll include you. And that means nearly all of us will love someone with dementia or know someone that does. The medical and social implications of cognitive decline are profound, but the spiritual and philosophical questions are no less challenging. Who are you if you don't remember who you are? And if you're religious, what does it mean to forget God? This week on the panel, we have a special guest. John Swinton is a major figure in the development of disability theology. He's a minister of the Church of Scotland. He holds the chair in divinity at the University of Aberdeen, where he founded the Centre for Spirituality, Health and Disability. He's written more than a dozen books, though it was his landmark text, Dementia, Living in the Memories of God, that's drawn much of his international acclaim. He's just arrived in Sydney on a sabbatical. He'll be consulting as well with the specialist dementia care provider Hammond Care. Professor John Swinton, welcome to Australia and a warm welcome to God Forbid.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So tell me about the nearly 20 years you worked as a mental health care nurse and then a chaplain in what were once called dementia wards.
Yeah, I trained originally as a psychiatric nurse. And then I retrained and worked alongside people with intellectual disabilities. And I worked in what was then the last children's hospital for people with intellectual disabilities, which is really, really interesting. And then in the late 80s, I kind of wandered into theology as a hospital chaplain, working alongside people with severe mental health challenges, which meant I was working with people who were moving from psychiatric wards back into the community. And my job was to help them find a sense of spiritual home, which was a fantastic job, if a bit depressing, because religious communities can be equally as stigmatized and excluding as anybody else. So I learned that early on.
So you worked with the very old, you worked with the very young, you worked with the mentally ill, you worked with the people who've had cognitive damage, you've worked with people with age-related cognitive decline. If you knew over those years what you knew now, what would you have done differently?
I would be a different nurse, really. However, having said that, I mean, wisdom takes time. If I had all the knowledge, then I wouldn't have all the experience, so it would be difficult. But I would definitely look at people differently. But I think I did that anyway, because I think if you spend your life hanging around with people who see the world differently, you begin to see the world differently yourself. So I think that it would have been impossible for me to see the world differently without the experience, even if I had the knowledge.
How does a person with a who sees the world through the prism of a psychotic illness make you see the world differently when you don't have one?
Well, that's interesting, because I've spent a lot of time with people with psychotic illness and beginning to work out what that means. So take something like hearing voices. Something like between 5 and 18% of the non-psychiatric population hear voices. In other words, there's more people who hear voices who are not in psychiatric care than are in psychiatric care. So hearing voices is not radically different. It's just perceived as different. When you begin to think about that, you begin to look at people's voices differently. And when you look at them differently, you listen to them differently. You begin to see that these are meaningful experiences, not simply symptoms, but actually part of people's narratives, and as such really have to be listened to.
And you therefore also learn that the line between the free outside world and the psychiatric hospital, the aged care centre, the dementia care ward, the nursing home, the hospital, the lines are arbitrary.
They are arbitrary. That's absolutely right. And what's quite interesting is the position of the psychiatric hospital, for example. In my own hometown in Aberdeen, when the first psychiatric hospital was built, it was right on the edge of the city, which is a big statement about where you think people should be. You still have a perception that there's something different.
And you could move the church off the hill as well.
You could do both of these things, yeah.
Also on the God Forbid panel, we have Dr. Robin Wrigley Carr. She's a senior lecturer in theology and spirituality at Alpha Crucis College in Sydney. She studied theology at Oxford, at the University of St. Andrews and Regent College and other institutions of higher learning. She's currently researching how people with dementia experience corporate religious services, chapel services, religious services, this kind of thing, in nursing homes. Dr. Robin Wrigley Carr, welcome to God Forbid.
Thanks for having me.
Your connection to dementia is professional, but very personal too. Tell me about caring for your late mother.
Yeah, I think it's really journeying with Mum over about a decade. She had Lewy bodies dementia, which is a very challenging form of dementia because of all the hallucinations that go with it and the confusion and the agitation that comes as a result.
What did she see?
Oh, all sorts of things. Often children. You know, she'd come and visit with Dad and then she'd say, you know, I've got to go and get the kids out of the car. And, you know, in that sort of situation, rather than just say, oh, there's no kids, Mum, it's fine, I'd say, okay, let's go back to the car and have a look. And we'd see there were none and then we'd come back in the house. Or at one stage she thought there was another man in the house who really was her husband and Dad wasn't the husband, so where was he going to sleep tonight? I mean, that was a really challenging one for my dad to cope with, but it was often seeing people and very often children.
And through all of this, in you, your father, and presumably still in your mother, even though she had dementia, there was Christianity?
Yes, very much a very strong faith in our family. And so I remember even when she did go into a nursing home for the last 8 weeks of her life, she was very agitated and I said to Mum, can I pray for you? And she said yes, and I just prayed a very simple prayer, did the sign of the cross on her forehead, and there was a marked shift in her behaviour after that.
Now, the secular neurologist who walked past might have said, oh, well, you know, that's, I just saw something similar the other day when someone played Scott Joplin music, and it was no more than that. Similarly, I welcome having Christianity in the nursing home, but that's only to make someone feel better, like massage. What do you say to that?
Well, I think I have a fairly broad understanding of spirituality and really see spirituality as whatever gives someone purpose or meaning or hope. You know, for one person, it might be listening to the Scott Joplin or it might be cheering for their favourite rugby team.
But Scott Joplin's not sacred.
And neither's rugby.
Neither's, I thought you were going to say neither's Christianity.
But if it's something that's giving them a sense of meaning and purpose and joy and hope, there's something spiritual about it. So I'm going broader than just religious convictions.
What do you think, John? This idea that religion is a useful tool in the same way that, functional, like sunburn cream.
I think it's more than that. You're with somebody in the context of worship who lives with dementia and they start to sing or whatever it is. You're always very easy to say, well, this is just hard ingrained neurological pathways that now come to life. But there's a different way you can think about it. Now, I have a friend who has just written a book called You Are What You Worship. So if you love shopping, you'll shape yourself in that way. If you love athletics, you'll become that. But if you get engaged in worship, you actually become that. So over time, your body takes the shape and the form of the worship acts. Music opens up memories that are actually not available unless the music is playing. It's like a key that opens up things. Sometimes memories are not absent, but the neural pathways that enable us to get to the memories are not accessible. And so what the brain and all its plasticity and cleverness does is it redirects the impulse round the broken neurology and into the memory. And music is a good way in which it does that. So when a person hears music, they access these memories. And when you hear these memories or remember these memories, you go back to a certain time and a space and a place and emotions and feelings. And so it's a wonderful experience that people may be having when that music is playing, but only for the length of time that the music plays. As soon as the music goes, it disappears. But your formation, the experience you have, the way in which your body is shaped and formed in the context of worship, I think means it's meaningful and intentional rather than just spontaneous.
Look, probably the best dementia nursing care home in the world is De Hogeveen near Amsterdam in Holland. It's like a gated community more than a nursing home. People live in actual houses and six to a house. There are doctors and nurses around the clock. You can go to the supermarket, the hairdresser, the movies, the pub, the restaurants. Now, they're all staffed, as I'm sure you know, not by waiters and sales assistants, but by trained aged care professionals. So it's the gold standard. Yet this is what, have a listen, their very own manager said when Yvonne Van Amorongen learnt that her father had died at the age of 63.
Well, my mother called me and said, your father died. And I stepped in the car and drove up to my parents' house. And one of the first thoughts I had driving up there was, God bless, he never went to a nursing home. And that is a very strange thought if you're a manager in a nursing home. A disturbing thought.
That's Yvonne van Amerongen, her TED talk about how she was glad her dad wasn't admitted into the nursing home she runs, even though it's perhaps the best in the world. Robin Wrigley Carr, what does that say? Is it a disturbing thought for you too?
You know, it was an agonising decision when we put my mother into a nursing home, but it was inevitable. It was there was no other choice.
Did the absence of choice take away that, forgive me for presuming, like a sting of betrayal? I only say this from personal family experience, even though I knew what we were doing was logically and intellectually right.
You know, I would say that my grief began the day that we made that decision. I remember my dad and my sisters, we all got together and made the decision together as a family. And as I said, she was only there for about 8 weeks before she passed away. But my dad was physically unable to care for her anymore. But I think we felt really happy with the care. We felt that the nurses were kind and attentive. And I used to take her out in the garden and she could see the sky and we could talk about the cat and the flowers and all of that. And it was really quite a lovely environment. So I suppose my grief happened not because I was putting her into a nursing home, but because I recognised I was losing her. I recognised she was starting to leave us.
And Professor John Swinton, what do you think about the idea that care can be of outstanding quality, it can be in the best interests of the person, and it can also be, as Yvonne van Amerongen said, a disturbing thought?
I think it's always a disturbing thought when you have to give up power to other people. I mean, to be able to have to hand your loved one over to a group of people that you don't really know is a disturbing thought in itself. And so I think one of the key things in relation to care provision is to ask the question, do people trust us with their loved ones? And do people trust the kind of care that we're given will enhance their life rather than simply warehouse them? If you look at the surveys that look at how people think about dementia, you know, people fear dementia more than they do cancer. Yeah. And I think that's partly because there's that sense that you're losing yourself. And I think that's some interesting things in there is why we think that our memory defines who we are. I think it raises a really interesting question.
On RN, it is God Forbid, we're with Reverend Professor John Swinton, Church of Scotland Minister, Chair of Divinity at the University of Aberdeen, and the author of more than a dozen books, including Dementia, Living in the Memories of God. Also with Dr. Robin Wrigley Card, Senior Lecturer in Theology and Spirituality at Alpha Crucis College in Sydney. Up next, we'll get a scientific understanding of dementia, its causes, and perhaps one day its cure. Thousands of Australians with dementia have not been and will never be diagnosed. They experience some form of cognitive decline without the care of the medical profession. Conversely, thousands are diagnosed, and for many that brings an automatic assumption of decline even when there isn't any. It's a perverse intersection between an uneven health system and the prejudice of those who work in it. Disability advocate Kate Swaffer is the 2017 South Australian of the Year. She's the founder and CEO of Dementia Alliance International, and she was diagnosed with younger onset dementia at just 49 years of age. But she says it wasn't the symptoms of the disease that suddenly changed her life, but rather the prejudice of others, even from those who should have known better. Have a listen to Kate Swaffer with a language warning. She hasn't forgotten her straight-to-the-point Aussie honesty.
Well, the day I was diagnosed, I was working full-time, studying at university, doing a double degree, bringing up teenage kids, running a house, volunteering, doing all the, you know, mad middle-aged mother stuff. Why would it be even vaguely logical that the minute after diagnosis, I wasn't capable of doing anything all of a sudden? A psychologist stood up. Having heard me say how offensive, insensitive, hurtful, he stood up at the microphone and said, "But you don't look like you've got dementia." And I said, "And you don't look like an asshole."
Kate Swaffer, mistaken in her initial assumption, it seems. She's living with Alzheimer's and advocating passionately for people with Alzheimer's. John Swinton, you've arrived in Australia. Do you think your Scottish Presbyterianism will sit comfortably with the Aussie larrikinism?
I've no idea how to answer that question.
Look, the point Kate Swaffer makes again and again in her advocacy for people with dementia is that every individual is unique, and not just psychosocially. Mm-hmm. No two neurological cases are the same. And this is where we will turn to Professor Bryce Vissel. He thinks a radical rethink into dementia is badly needed. He's Director of Neuroscience and Regenerative Medicine at the University of Technology, Sydney, and he's speaking with RN's Rowan Salmond.
I think the truth is with dementia that no two people are exactly the same. And indeed, we do know that there are different forms of dementia, of which one is Alzheimer's, for example. In general, dementia, you're talking about a loss primarily in the early stages of short-term memory. As the disease proceeds, it starts to affect longer-term memory. And in addition to memory, it starts to spread into other areas as well. So it starts to affect movement. And eventually, it starts to affect things like swallowing. So unfortunately, people often die of something like pneumonia rather than of the dementia itself. So it's a very sad and very tragic condition that we're talking about with dementia. Mm.
And what does dementia actually do to the brain physically?
Every person who has dementia has a slightly different set of things going on in the brain, but generally speaking, they're characterized by a loss of synapses. That's the connection between nerve cells, and we don't know which of those are causative and which of those are the consequence. But the brain, on death, is quite a big loss of nerve cell tissue, and it's quite obvious once a person's died, there's quite a profound loss of brain tissue. Yeah.
And what's the research that you're doing into this area?
Yeah, so there's no treatment for dementia really at the moment. There's a couple of drugs that can be given. There's dispute about how effective those drugs are and are they effective at all. Apart from that, people have been focusing on trying to remove something called amyloid from the brain. There's this plaque-like substance that exists in the brain of people with dementia. And for a long time, scientists have been thinking that's the cause of dementia, and some people still think that. We, a long time ago, were saying we don't think this is the answer, the sole answer to dementia. We've got to get in there and understand it more substantially. We've become interested in something called inflammation in the brain. We came interested in that about 10 years ago before it became more widely accepted, and how inflammation, that is the immune response in the brain, I guess, that occurs during Alzheimer's, may cause the loss of the synapses or the loss of connections, and how we can reverse that. We believe it's going to be possible.
So for somebody who's going through the stages of dementia, what are they experiencing?
I guess there's an awareness of this loss that's happening to you. It's quite a devastating feeling of helplessness, I think. And again, recognizing every person is different. My observations, and this is not a scientific thought, but just my observations, I think it's terrifying that they're not understanding what's happening in the world around them. They're in a hospital, they don't understand why they're there, and they don't understand who they can trust and who they can't trust. And then beyond that, we don't actually know, because as people become further advanced, their communication capacity starts to shut down, and we don't fully understand what the person's experiencing. Having said that, we believe that certain aspects of the brain are still quite functional for a very long time. It's interesting because one of the things that you see with people who've got classical Alzheimer's is that they still have very good social skills, and they can interact with you very nicely and offer you a cup of tea and do all those sort of social things, but they don't remember who you are and who they're interacting with and whether you're important or whether you're not important. It becomes very, very hard to maintain an identity in those kind of circumstances, I think, and it's hard.
Tell me a little bit about whole person individualized care. What is that?
Right. So science has gotten really good at saying you've got an infection, we know the antibiotic, and you'll knock off the infection and people get better. This is also true for blood pressure. You know, we've gotten that worked out down to the molecular level. And we know that we can give certain drugs that together have a good chance of bringing blood pressure or hypertension under control. In the case of dementia, it's extremely complicated. I don't think it's understandable as a single cause leading to a single disease. We've got to get a lot better at trying to subdivide people into the kinds of dementias they have, the kinds of deficiencies, the kinds of lifestyle issues that they're confronting, and see if we can come up with a more holistic medical approach. I think the patient or the person with dementia, if treated as a person with a memory problem, there's a lot that we can do to create a context of an environment around them, makes it much safer for them. but also treating the person with dignity and respect. You know, there's a tendency if someone doesn't know how to sit on the toilet properly anymore to just undress them and put them on the toilet. Well, they're still a human being and they can get angry and respond. And now they're being told that they're angry. But in fact, they're not being treated necessarily as the way they need to be, with dignity, kindness, respect. Can we create a context, an environment, a way of living that maximizes their current brain capacity that is left, and also makes them feel they are being treated with dignity and kindness? I think that can be very powerful.
That's Professor Bryce Vissel, Director of Neuroscience and Regenerative Medicine at the University of Technology, Sydney. He was speaking with RN's Rowan Salmond. Well, Dr. Robin Wrigley-Carr, what's your response to him?
Well, I think what he's saying about treating people with dignity is key. And the key is actually love. The person with dementia needs to know that they're valued and loved. It's a whole way of holding someone.
I mean, like Bryce was talking about when a patient gets angry because they're, maybe I shouldn't say patient, maybe a person gets angry when they're being toileted in an insensitive way and they go, oh, look, they're angry. That's the dementia getting worse. You know, well, actually, no, it's me being disrespected.
Yeah, and reacting rightfully at one level. I suppose the challenge with dementia care is the workers being so full of jobs. We need the time to be able to spend being attentive to people, and often that's not there.
In a big ward, there's not enough time to sit and take the time
that's
needed.
There's a lot of tasks to be done, so the person becomes like an object. And the task has to be done and then I'll get on to the next task, as opposed to actually really greeting them and being present with them. So it's a time issue, and probably we need to have more funding so that people's loads are not as strenuous.
John Swinton, I'm sure you would agree, but our culture is oriented around hard science and the research for the cure, and millions need to go into this idea of saying, imagine if you'd found a new drug for dementia and it was experimental and it would cost you $10 million to give it to 20 patients. You could spend that $10 million employing nurses to find out why the patient's upset.
Yeah.
Now, on one level, we say, oh, well, that's a waste of money. I mean, we had the technology for a nurse to do that 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And once that nurse has been employed for a year, we're still not closer to a cure.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a waste of money?
Well, it's interesting. Although there's a lot of money going into research on dementia, there's actually very little come out. And the people that you're talking about, the thousands of Australians that you mentioned at the beginning of this program, are people for whom there will never be a cure. And actually, the many millions of people across the world, there will never be a cure. And so I think culturally we should maybe begin to think differently and think about assigning our finances to care and to shift our mindset away from being terrified about dementia, not to say stop research and continued research, it's just not happening at this moment in time, and to think about what it means to be a caring society, to think about how our economics actually may have to be reframed slightly so that we create spaces where people can be cared for. Because when people with dementia are cared for properly, you're actually surprised at how capable they can be of doing things that they are not able to do if they're cared for in a less stimulating environment, for example.
You say people with dementia have false identities implicitly and explicitly imposed upon them. Give me some examples.
Well, as soon as you have a diagnosis of dementia, suddenly everything is sucked into that. You can no longer lose your keys. You actually, everything that comes from your dementia. Now, stigma works in exactly that same way. So you get a highly stigmatized condition like dementia, and everything is reduced into there. People will say things like, well, he or she is not the person that she used to be, or I'd rather not visit them because I want to think about them the way they are. And so people disappear in people's conceptions.
Family says, my mum, my husband, as I knew her, is dead.
Yeah.
But on a level, isn't that true?
I think it's certainly not true that the person is dead, but from a family's point of view, it is true that there's a lot of grief, that there is a certain way in which you've known this individual that's not available to you now, and you need to work out how to do that. For culture to say the same things, or for people beyond the family to say the same things, is completely inappropriate because it's a different mode of relationship. It's even the language that you use. So, you know, we talk about people being angry, or we talk about people wandering. I mean, Have you ever wandered in your life? I mean, it's very rare. You're always going somewhere. And a person with dementia is going somewhere. And you're not angry about nothing. It's not you're just this kind of ridiculous anger that just comes upon you. Very often there's reasons why people are angry. And when you break it down, you can see exactly why a person would be angry.
I'm losing my keys. You're in the midst of a key-lossing disease.
Precisely.
Understood. On RN, it is God Forbid. You can subscribe to this podcast on the ABC Listen app, and you can even listen to RN on digital TV, Channel 26. The future is now. ABC RN. Up next, Aging Well, with or without dementia. Dementia is a degenerative condition. It gets worse over time. So does that mean if you have it, you're aging badly? Not at all, says Elizabeth McKinley. She says the question of aging well is far more complex than that. And what we project onto others as healthy or unhealthy, well or sick, may bear little resemblance to the actual life experience of the person in question, regardless of whether they have dementia. This applies to all people. Elizabeth McKinley is a professor at Charles Sturt University, a registered nurse as well, and an Anglican priest, the inaugural director of the Centre for Ageing and Pastoral Studies at St Mark's National Theological Centre in Canberra. She's the author of The Spiritual Dimension of Ageing, and she's speaking with David Rutledge from RN's Encounter.
If we're looking at purely a biomedical model, we tend to look at ageing in good health, and we're only ageing well if we're indeed in good health. But I think if we take a psychosocial model or indeed a spiritual or theological model, what does that mean to be growing older? Ageing is a spiritual journey that embraces negative things that we experience in life as well as the positive experiences. And in fact, in some of my early studies where I asked frail elderly people with very, very limited mobility who were residents in aged care facilities how healthy they thought they were. Some of them who were appeared quite disabled say, oh, I'm extremely healthy. And it was a sense of peace and joy that lies at the centre, and it's to do with the transcendence of the disabilities and the sufferings that we experience in life. So aging well, I think, is a really complex phenomenon.
This becomes problematic, of course, when we consider dementia, because our entire modern liberal culture is based on a concept of personhood that sees human worth, but even human being, the actual definition of a human, it's a function of reason, reflection, self-consciousness, autonomy, and so on. These are obviously tricky categories to bring to someone with dementia.
Yep. It's becoming increasingly apparent to me that autonomy is a false goal in a complex Western society. And we really need to look at autonomy in the context of community, because that's how human beings are hardwired for relationship. And we have to look at what is a person, how do we define personhood, how do we define identity. Sometimes people will say in dementia, the person is lost, they have no self. The more I have worked with people with dementia, it seems that the person remains. What is difficult and becomes increasingly difficult are the cognitive structures. But the cognitive structures are not the sum total of the human being. Importantly, in the human being are emotions, the reflective nature, and in the work we have done with people with dementia, I have seen wisdom in these people. Wisdom in the ability to deal with complexity, to deal with ambiguity, to deal with uncertainty of life, and to sometimes, given the opportunity in a supported environment, to actually be able to express in quite profound words how they are feeling in the midst of this incredible difficulty.
Well, you mentioned earlier the process of spiritual reflection, certain ways of working with people near the ends of their lives. How do you approach that with a person with dementia, or do you work in that way?
Yep, we certainly do. And in fact, we approach it just the same way as we would with people without dementia, except perhaps we would tend to give them more time, we would sit with them, but we ask the same kind of questions. We ask what's most important in their lives, where do they find meaning in their lives, and we find, you know, when we ask them questions about joy or hope, they're able to answer these kinds of questions where they can't answer questions that ask for facts.
That's Professor Elizabeth McKinlay from Charles Sturt University. We'll put a link to that episode of RN's Encounter, The Spiritual Dimension of Aging, with David Rutledge on the God Forbid website. Well, Dr. Robin Wrigley Carr, people with dementia talk more easily about joy and hope than facts and figures, says Elizabeth McKinlay. Was that your experience with your mum and the older people you work with now?
Yeah, I think it's extraordinary. Some of the conversations you can have with people with dementia, they might look like they're vacant and not much is happening. But just a few weeks ago, I was talking with a gentleman in the aged care home where I'm doing my research, and he just launched into this enormous long monologue about the Japanese invasion of Sydney Harbour in 1942 and his experience of being at a chapel service that was packed. It was mind-blowing, the conversation that we were having. It would have been easy to just dismiss him as someone who didn't have much to contribute. And I didn't really ask any searching questions for this to come out. It just exploded out. I suppose with my mum, it's a different relationship to someone I'm just meeting at an aged care home. In my relationship with her, I would be saying things like, thanks for being a good mum. And I remember her pausing and looking me straight in the eye. This is at very advanced dementia, and she just said to me, I hope so. And that was a very perceptive response, because the relationship had sometimes been quite challenging. I remember a couple of days later, I took my daughters to say goodbye to her, and I said, thanks for being a great grandma. And then I said, have they been good granddaughters? And she just laughed, had a twinkle in her eye, and she said, oh, they've been terrible. Now, even at this stage of late dementia, she had a playfulness about her. We knew how much she adored the kids. So I think the point I'm trying to say is, because I knew her well and I had a lot of time to spend with her, we would have these moments of deep connection, of being able to talk about the relationships that most mattered to her, even when she was, you know, pretty far gone and only often awake early in the morning. I would visit her when I knew she was most alert and receptive.
Well, she, even in the late stage, she expressed hope and she expressed love. So on one level, if you've got those two things, if you haven't forgotten how to hope and love, you're not really in too much of a different basket on a certain level than anyone else.
I think earlier when someone made the point about I feel like the person's dead, I found myself sitting here reacting to that comment, because in my experience, my mother was very much alive in her advanced dementia right to the end. But getting back to John's point about investing more funding in care for people with dementia, so we're not just rushing around doing the jobs around them, but actually having the time to spend and listen, I think it's when we have that listening presence, even if there's a lot of silence, that's not wasted time. We're present to them and they know we're there, and bits of conversation and connection happen. And I think especially stimulating the senses can bring forth connection, whether it's music or the smell of flowers or touch or the use of rituals.
Yes. Reverend Professor John Swinton, mercifully, Robin's mother did not forget how to hope and how to love. Can one forget how to do that with dementia?
You could forget anything with dementia, because memory is a neurological process. So if you no longer have the ability to do that, then you will no longer be able to do that. Let me answer it in terms of what it means in terms of relationship. When we think about things like faith and hope and love, we tend to think about these as intellectual concepts that we have to articulate. But actually, when you think about something like love, not a concept or an idea. It's actually an experience. You can experience faith and hope and love through your relationship, through the warmth of somebody's touch, through the engagement with their eyes at particular moments in time, without having been able to articulate that. So it may well be that in terms of your neurological condition, you can no longer cognitively do that, but you can certainly experience that.
How do you know that?
Well, I know that because the most loving and intimate experiences that I have in my life, I can't articulate that. They just happen when I hold my kids or when I hold my wife or something happens that brings about a certain emotion. And I can't talk about that and I don't have to talk about that, but I know it's real.
So it's not significant if you go from being a devout Christian to forgetting who Jesus Christ was?
Well, the key point would be that God doesn't forget who you are, right? So you may well forget. You know, you could go out of this place today, fall down the stairs and end up with serious brain damage. So at the top of the stairs, you'll know all about God. The bottom of the stairs, you'll know nothing about God.
Is that the other way around, possibly?
Possibly. That's not for me to pass judgment. But if being a Christian or having faith was simply to do with remembering these things, then we're all in trouble. Where who we are is held within the memory of God, not simply within our own memories.
On our end, it's God forbid. More of this next, but with a tricky angle. Therapeutic deception, it's called. The lies we tell people because we love them. If you're caring for someone with dementia and they're upset because they can't find their husband or wife, when in fact their spouse died 40 years ago, what do you do? Do you tell them the cold hard truth? Your soulmate is dead. Do you tell them again in an hour's time once they've forgotten the news, repeating the grief of earlier again and again and again? Or do you lie and say your husband's just popped down to the shops in the expectation that in a few minutes the whole thing will be forgotten? If you've opted for the second choice, you're engaging in what's called therapeutic deception. White lies, benign falsehoods aimed at alleviating distress, but also at saving time for carers. It's a common practice in dementia care, and it's generally humane and well-intentioned, but it is deception. So is it morally wrong? Julian Hughes is Honorary Professor of Old Age Psychiatry at the University of Bristol in the UK. He was recently in Australia and spoke to David Rutledge for RN's Philosopher's Zone.
First of all, it has to be agreed it is in the best interest of the person to tell the lie, and that means speaking to the family, speaking to all the carers involved and so on. But it has to be for very specific instances, so you can't just construct a care plan which says, oh, we can now just lie to this person all the time. You say we can lie about this specific issue. The point of all of this is to show that it's a rather extraordinary thing to do, to be telling someone a lie.
I wonder if you feel that if lying, if therapeutic lying or practices of deception become prevalent, then in a sense this changes the way in which people with dementia are perceived as a class, if you like. These are people you can lie to, right? And once you can lie to them, presumably you can treat them in other ways that we would normally consider to be morally beyond the pale. It's a thin end of the wedge argument, I suppose. Is it one that concerns you?
Absolutely. I suppose lying and other forms of deception, they are just undermining the standing of the person with dementia. I suppose the excuse is that it's not going to harm them and it may do some good. But on the other hand, I think that excuse for lying, there's always the danger that that can be rolled out too soon. A mate of mine called Steve Sabat, who's a retired professor from Georgetown University in Washington, he wrote an excellent book called The Experience of Alzheimer's Disease, Life Through a Tangled Veil, in which he talks about malignant positioning. So this is what people can do. It's not that they are malignant. They may be very, very caring, but they position the person in such a way as to make things worse. So they position them as being incapable of doing something. And I think lying is another way of positioning people as being incapable, or it's a way of patronizing or infantilizing them. And I suppose another aspect to this is the sort of controversy that there is at the moment around the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. What that convention is really pushing is the notion that if you have a disability, including dementia, you should still be treated on a completely equal footing with everybody else. Now, people object to this and they say, well, this is crazy if you're talking about very, very severe dementia where the person, for instance, can't talk and is totally dependent on other people for all of their basic needs. And are you really saying that these people are on an equal footing with, you know, somebody in middle life who's perfectly fit and well? But what the human rights lawyers say, that if you start drawing lines, what will tend to happen is that people will, there is not that they'll push the boundaries, it's more that they'll pull the boundaries backwards and they'll start to say, well, okay, you know, we can start to lie to this person because it seems to us that they, you know, that we don't think that they're up to it. Even though, if we jump back to Steve Sabbat, in his book, he shows that you can have a conversation with somebody who definitely has severe dementia and has communication problems. And yet, if you approach the conversation in the right way, if you give them enough time, their meanings, their wishes, their preferences will emerge. And to tell a lie, in a way, is just often a means for the person who's talking to the person with dementia to shortcut a difficult, longer conversation.
That's Professor of Old Age Psychiatry at the University of Bristol, Julian Hughes, speaking with David Rutledge from RN's The Philosopher's Zone. We'll put a link to the full interview on the God Forbid website. Well, Professor John Swinton, in all your years as a nurse, did you engage in therapeutic deception?
I remember a friend of mine whose son committed suicide, and his sister had to tell his mum and dad that this had happened. His mum and dad were in the advanced stages of dementia, and she told them, and they were deeply traumatised, as you may imagine. But then 20 minutes later, they'd forgotten it. And so she told them again, and the same thing. And so she eventually came to the conclusion that she couldn't constantly be re-traumatizing them. And so she decided in that situation not to talk about it and not to keep on telling them the same thing. I mean, that was a very considered decision. Compassion was what she was really trying to draw out of that situation. If you're going to engage in that kind of avoidance of the truth, if you like, then it has to be intentional. And you have to go through a process where you're thinking it through, you're really working it through, so that you don't end up with a culture of lying. And then compassion becomes actually defined by the context that you want it to be defined by. And so I think it's highly complicated. Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote a very interesting essay on lying. And so he said, for example, if an axeman comes to your door looking for your family, the right thing to do is to say they're upstairs. And Bonhoeffer says, this is ridiculous. And so he begins to think about, actually, truth-telling needs to be in the service of love. And I think there's something about that there.
And Robin Wrigley Carr, what about you and your mum and truth?
I can't think of any time when we as a family had to tell untruths to mum. But I can remember just a couple of weeks ago at the nursing home, there was a resident and the husband sitting with me, and the resident said to me, oh yes, we've been living here for X months. And the husband says, oh no, you just live here, I just visit every day. And the conversation just went on. That's a very small example of just simply telling the truth and moving on gently, but not making a big deal of it. I can think of another friend whose mother has advanced dementia. The father died last year, and every time she visits, the mother says, where's Dad? Well, he's passed away, and she would be traumatised, a bit like John's example. And now they just change the subject. So I wonder about the truth of distraction and just gently moving on to another topic. And I'm glad in a lot of ways that we were never faced with having as a family to work out, do we lie about something with mum? We were never in that situation. I don't know that I would have felt comfortable with it, but I get that in some situations it might be the way ahead. And I liked the way Julian was talking about in consultation with the family and it being something that's very thoughtfully engaged with, not carelessly.
Well, final question to you both on this. Do you fear one day you might get dementia, and how do you want to be treated if you do, Robin?
Well, dementia is actually in my family line. I remember as a child visiting both grandmas in nursing homes. My mother's had it. I suppose one of the things that I found very moving with my mother having dementia was seeing the care of my three daughters, especially my middle one, who has a huge heart and is slightly quirky and loves people who are different. And the way that she was with my mum was deeply moving. And I thought, well, if I can have her be kind to me in that way, I'm in good hands. So do I fear it? You know, I don't think about it. I get on with my life. My life is in God's hands. But for now, I've seen the people close to me caring for my mum in a very deeply moving way, which gives me confidence that I will be in safe hands and ultimately in God's hands. I won't be forgotten by him.
They sound like great girls. John Swinton.
I don't think I fear dementia. I mean, I have some anxiety about how people will treat me if I get anxiety. But what I'd like is just for people just to love me through the changes. Like, and I'd like services that just think that way. That what does it mean to love somebody through the changes? And so that would be my hope.
More worried about the institutions rather than the relationships of your life.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, on that note, poignant. We move to something rather unpoignant, the Wits End Quiz, next.
Wits End!
Yes, it's Wits End, the God Forbid Quiz. This week, two experts on ageing test the wisdom they've acquired over their lives. As always, we begin with the buzzers. Professor John Swinton, you've got cigar-smoking comedian George Burns, who died in 1996 at the age of 100. Test your buzzer.
When you get to be my age, the most important thing is to get out of bed.
George Burns. Dr. Robin Wrigley Carr, you've got the 97-year-old comedian Betty White. She's still with us, going strong, and here's her health secret. Test your buzzer.
I have a two-story house and a very bad memory, so I'm up and down those stairs.
Okay, buzzers are working. She's got very strong quads and core strength. First question. Old People's Home for Four-Year-Olds is currently screening on ABC TV. It's a doco revealing the mutual benefits of kindergarten kids visiting nursing homes. One of the kids in the show is Jax, and he's asked whether old people get sad. His reply is yes, because A, they're forced to take afternoon naps, B, they're only allowed an hour's screen time a day, C, no one will play with them, or D, they still think Labor wants to take their franking credits.
I have a two-story house and a very bad memory, so I'm up and down those stairs.
C.
C, no one wants to play with them. Let's see if Robin Wrigley Carr is correct. Here's Jax with the answer.
Do you think old people ever get sad?
Yes.
Why are they sad?
Because no one
plays
with them.
4-year-old Jax makes Robin Wrigley Carr a winner, and you must check out Old People's Home for 4-year-olds Tuesday, 8:30 on ABC One or iView. Have you seen the first episode, Robin?
Yes, I've seen the first two episodes.
Enjoy it?
Thoroughly enjoy it. Yeah, it's a fascinating experiment.
This is my next question. Did any of the following presidents of the United States have dementia while in office? Kennedy, Ford, Reagan, Bush Sr.
When you get to be my age, the most important thing is to get out of bed.
Reagan.
Reagan is the answer from Professor John Swinton. Officially, well, there's no official answer. Historians have argued about it. What we do know is that Alzheimer's is often present many years before memory loss becomes apparent. And we also know that President Reagan officially announced that he did have Alzheimer's 5 years after leaving office, passing away a decade later. So the debate will go on as to whether or not he had it, I suppose, in office in the future. But a follow-up question is, in 2016, a comedy movie called Reagan was going to be made but was abandoned after a public outcry because it made fun of President Reagan's Alzheimer's. Have a listen.
Outraged today over a controversial new movie. The new film depicts Reagan in his second term in office when some say he was already showing early signs of Alzheimer's disease. Gail Hodges Burt was the late Nancy Reagan's social secretary.
The subject matter is not a funny subject matter.
Which comedian was going to play Ronald Reagan before pulling out of that role? Any guesses? He does an imitation of George Bush Jr., which is very funny. Impersonation. Will Ferrell it was going to be. The premise of the movie was that Reagan was convinced he was an actor who was playing the role of president when in fact he was actually president. John Swinton, do you think dementia is not an appropriate topic for that kind of satire or comedy?
I think you're better not to joke about it.
Next question. CNN founder Ted Turner has revealed that he is suffering from the same form of dementia that Robin Williams had, the comedian. Which is it?
I have a two-story house and a very bad memory, so I'm up and down those stairs.
It was Lewy Bodies, wasn't it?
That's correct, Robin Wrigley Carr. In the case of Robin Williams, his Lewy Bodies dementia wasn't discovered until his brain was studied in an autopsy. Mm. His widow, Susan, wrote a moving editorial about it in the journal Neurology. Next question. A world-famous English woman had dementia late in life. Her daughter wrote a memoir of the experience. Quote, "Watching her struggle with her words and memory, I couldn't believe it. I had always thought of her as ageless, timeless, and 100% cast iron damage proof." Who is she referring to? I'll give you a clue. Cast iron.
Oh, Margaret Thatcher.
The Iron Lady.
That was a good clue.
Yeah, Margaret Thatcher is correct. Next question. Labour Prime Minister Gough Whitlam died in 2012 at the age of 98. Right up to the end, he kept active. He would still go to his office, engage in correspondence, receive friends and dignitaries, and keep abreast of public affairs. At his memorial service, his speechwriter and closest confidant, Graham Freudenberg, who sadly now has passed away too, made a veiled reference to Gough's dementia. Have a listen.
"In his rich and mellow autumn, he worried occasionally lest he be like King Charles, remembered mainly."
Gough worried that he'd be like King Charles, remembered mainly for what? No? Guesses? Well, here's Gough's mate Freudy with the answer.
"Lest he be like King Charles, remembered mainly for losing his head."
Gough never lost his sense of humour. And we have to say thank you to our wonderful panel of two for a most informative, moving, stimulating episode of God Forbid this week. Professor John Swinton, thank you.
Pleasure, thank you.
Dr. Robin Wrigley Carr, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And Robin's a senior lecturer in theology and spirituality at Alpha Crucis College in Sydney. She's studied at Oxford, University of St Andrews, Regent College, and she's currently researching how people with dementia experience religious services in nursing homes. Reverend Professor John Swinton, Church of Scotland Minister, Chair in Divinity at the University of Aberdeen. He's the author of more than a dozen books, including Dementia, Living in the Memories of God. He's in Australia as an associate consultant for Hammond Care whilst he's on his sabbatical. Also next month, John will be speaking at Faith for Life seminars around Sydney, Memory, Worship and Dementia. We'll put a link to that on the God Forbid website. Don't forget you can subscribe on the ABC Listen app. That's the podcast. Old People's Home for Four-Year-Olds, Tuesday, 8:30, ABC One. Email me at godforbid@abc.net.au. And also don't forget you can now listen to all your favourite ABC radio stations, even though we know there's only one, which is RN, on your television. How does that make sense? Well, apparently you go to ABC RN on Channel 26, your free-to-air digital TV, radio on TV. I've watched TV on radio. It's much less entertaining. I'm James Carlton. Until next week, remember to be good. God forbid.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.